You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. In this episode, we're looking at next generation packaging, and we've put together an exciting package, do you like that, of experts who are challenging the packaging status quo through innovation and disruptive technologies. I want to explore the barriers to the development of new packaging and how to build momentum for plastic alternatives and other planet-friendly stuff that we may not have even heard of yet. So, here in the studio, we have Robin Clark, Global Director of Restaurant Services and Sustainability for Just Eat.
Hello.
Gordon McSkimming, Sustainable Packaging Manager from Coca-Cola European Partners.
Hello, Steph.
Pierre Paslier, co-founder of Notpla.
Hi.
Jim Cregan, co-founder of Jimmy's Iced Coffee.
Hello.
And Suze Cregan, also co-founder of Jimmy's Iced Coffee.
Hello.
So my first question is pretty broad. Now, with all of the noise around environmentally friendly packaging right now, I mean, we've got Extinction Rebellion bringing, you know, shedding light on lots of different things, David Attenborough showing plastic bags and all sorts. Is this an exciting time for packaging experts, or is it hell on earth? Gordon, exciting or hell?
Arguably a bit of both. Certainly exciting when you see the way in which packaging is developing, and I also think it's exciting when you see the way that consumer trends are going. You could also argue it's hell because of the pressure that's on us all to come up with new solutions and to come up with them quickly. So I would say a bit of both.
Okay. Now, Robin, it's not just about the packaging stuff itself, is it? It's about the concepts and the organisation surrounding it and the thought process that goes in from both the person putting the food in the packaging and the person taking the food out of the packaging. Whose responsibility is it?
Well, that's a great question. I think you're absolutely right. It's not about a single point in the supply chain. You've got to look at the entire process from start to finish. In my previous role at Tesco, they created a fantastic piece of work understanding waste from start to finish. And there are some statistics from that that say that we waste about a third of all the food that we use, but half of that waste comes before it even hits the supermarket shelves. About 0.4 to 0.6% happens in the supermarket, and the other half comes in the customer's home. And if you take packaging and look at what we're doing amongst us, then the impact of reducing packaging might have the knock-on effect of creating more waste. Mm-hmm. And food waste, that third that we waste, is one of the biggest issues for our carbon footprint.
So are you saying that if the packaging isn't effective enough, then more food goes to waste?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. These are the crazy things like putting a cellophane wrapper around a cucumber. Mm. It's actually quite important. Mm. And removing the plastic can increase the waste of the cucumber and therefore increase your carbon footprint. And so we've, in the work that we've done with Skipping Rocks, who are now called Notpla, we've tried to take a holistic approach to that work and understand from start to finish the impact of the changes we're making.
So, okay, well, can you give us some details then?
Yeah, so we have developed a material that we call Notpla that is made from seaweed, which makes it naturally biodegradable and even edible. So that shows how nature will be able to deal with it. And we're using this material to package sauces and condiments that typically you will get in your takeaway delivery box, so ketchup, mayo. And because our material is natural, it will have a short shelf life. But when you think of the takeaway industry, you're directly shipping something to someone who's going to consume it within a few hours. So when you look at applications where you know that things aren't going to last for very long, this is where natural materials like seaweed have a very important role to play, because they can literally match the time of use with the time of biodegradation of the material and the packaging.
That sounds fantastic. What are the barriers to entry for things like this?
So we were talking about the amount of waste and the amount of things that can go wrong in the supply chain. And when you think of the current supply chain, it's been essentially built around plastic. So we've developed an infrastructure that just works if you use plastic. Mm. So we have very big factories that produce for entire continents you have warehouses and hubs, and it's kind of like stopping three or four times before it makes it to the supermarket where it's going to stay in the shelf forever. So if you want to bring something that is a little bit more natural and it's not going to stay in the environment for hundreds of years, you have to rethink that model. So for example, for us, because our material has a short shelf life, we have to produce really close to consumption. So it means that we had to develop a machine that is very small, a bit like the size of a fridge, that can produce in like the 10 miles radius of where you're going to order your food, and that is basically going to be produced a few days before you consume it so that it works with a 2-week shelf life. So you have to take the whole system and turn it upside down.
It's true, the risk is as much as the advantage, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so coming to Jimmy's Iced Coffee, you sort of built a product and you must have sort of dealt with packaging really early on in the process.
Yeah.
Can you just sort of explain how that process works for somebody coming up with a new brand at the same time?
The inspiration was taken from Oz, where they package iced coffee into classic milk cartons, and that was the kind of stimulus for wanting to go into a milk carton kind of package. We didn't want to go into PET from the beginning because it just didn't fit.
We've got a couple of yours here. Can you just explain to the listener, because they can't see what is what you've got? I've just dropped on the table. What
it
you've
was
got
a
there.
Carton.
So we basically produce ready to drink iced coffee that comes in a carton or a can, and we're now moving into a shift into can out of a carton, and it's going to be quite an exciting journey how we get on with that.
And why is that? Why from can to carton?
Well, I mean, if we just go back to sort of your initial question, when we first launched, we weren't and we are not packaging manufacturers. We had a great idea that we wanted to bring to the UK market and beyond. And we were very governed by what was available to us. So we did know, Jim was right, we did want to go into a carton, and that was great, and it served a purpose.
Why did you want to start with a carton?
I think it was the nostalgic part that Jim had fallen in love with when he was in Oz, and it was it just felt like the right kind
of... It's the aesthetic behind it, because a product has to be a combination of branding and packaging and ingredients, and if they don't all sing together, then it doesn't necessarily work. And I fell in love with the idea of holding a carton, this kind of square box kind of thing, and that's the reason why.
In the beginning, that was we were in a chilled product, so we only had 60 days shelf life, which was absolutely terrible, especially in your startup days when you have sort of one store listing you. It was pretty tricky and there was a lot of wastage. And then we were very much just governed by what would be available to us. So Tetra Pak came with this Prisma carton, and they, you know, we went into it because it had a 9-month shelf life, and that made us all very excited. But then, you know, then sort of a couple of years on, when you get your head above the, you know, above the parapet, and you sort of look at the world around you, you then look at the cap, for instance, ignited by the David Attenborough thing, obviously, and you sort of think, I don't like that, but there's nothing we can do about it, because unless Tetra Pak or your packaging manufacturer change what your vessel is made up of, then you're a bit, your hands are tied, and I'm certainly not going to become a packaging manufacturer, because I'm not going to live long enough to mind to do something like that
as well. And it's interesting, because you're a smaller producer coming up with new products, and this is, I mean, there is a drift to lots more, you know, smaller brands kicking off and starting up and having to have what's there. You can't really order it and design your own new packaging, or can you? Mm. Is there latitude to it? Do you talk to Tetra Pak and say
we did, but to be honest, it just didn't really go anywhere. The best solution they came up with, which we thought was a non-plastic cap, which we got very excited about when we read the small print. It is actually still plastic. It's how they manufacture it is a cleaner way of doing it, which just didn't wash with us at all. And in fact, we were looking at aluminium about 5 years ago, so it's been that long coming to market. But there just wasn't somewhere in the UK that filled dairy into cans, because it has a unique filling system. So we would have gone into cans 5 years ago, which we would have felt was the right move for Jimmy's. But we've not been able to do it until this year, which is a real shame, because our hands were just automatically cuffed because there were just not the facilities in the UK for us to be able to do it.
And now there are.
No, there still aren't.
There still aren't.
No.
Okay.
We're having to move everything to Germany.
No.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
But we think it's only going to be short term, because we're really proud of the fact that we use British milk. and the fact that we are produced in our own country. And we're now looking for a essentially what I call a foster parent to essentially invest in some machinery for us and kind of take us on board so that we can actually bring manufacturing back home.
Yeah. So just tell us about the journey of the aluminium can. Is it infinitely recyclable?
It is.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Tell us more.
Well, because as Sue's kind of alluded to, we're not specialists in it, but what we do know is that there is a massive pressure against not using single-use plastic. And I guess there's the journey of the actual production of either a carton or a can or whichever packaging you've got. Then it gets home and then it's up to the consumer to put it in the correct bin. And then it's what happens once it's gone into that bin, how they then recycle it. So you could put a carbon footprint label on the whole thing. You could put a whole bunch of labels on that whole kind of sustainability piece. And it's kind of hard to measure. And I know, as you were alluding to, Robin, about being in Tesco, knowing the flow from start to finish. And I don't think we've had the completely correct answer, but from the advice we've had so far from consultants is that can is definitely the way forward.
Yeah. There'll be blockchain on the can, finding out where it's all going before we know. Now, Gordon, Coca-Cola, you must be dealing with lots of different types of new packaging. Now, I know that recycling and packaging is more than just about whizzy new materials, but can you tell us about some whizzy new materials? And is that, what are you working on? What's exciting? I mean, I love Pierre's Noplar product, but what else is knocking around now?
Well, just before I come on to the whizzy new materials, and I promise I'll come back to the whizzy new materials, because nobody loves a whizzy new material more than me. But I think you alluded to something there that I was just going to come in on, but that you talked about putting it in your recycling bin at home.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest barriers for everybody is the fact that there isn't a consistent pattern for
totally
consumers to do.
Yeah.
So you live in one council, and I live in a different council, and you live... And people don't know what to do. And
I think there's something like 400 different authorities with 500 different schemes, which doesn't necessarily make sense. Mm. You're right. If it was just a blanket, this is how it works, everyone would be really confident about putting the right products into the right bins.
Yeah, and one of the... I'm not forgetting about the question, new product.
I'll bring you back.
You know, you talked about barriers earlier. I think one of the barriers is just infrastructure.
I agree.
That people don't know what to do, and they see messaging on products, and they perhaps don't understand that. And they see different systems in different councils, and they, does this go in a blue bin or a green bin or all that sort of thing? And I think that's a real problem for all of us. And I think it's the sort of thing that manufacturers and suppliers can all do their bits, but it needs to come from government.
Okay, let's put the whizzy thing on hold for a second, because I think this is absolutely right. So there's another link in the chain, and that is the recycling system itself. Mm. Now, I've spoken to packaging designers who say, well, the recyclers can recycle everything that there is. It's all recyclable at some level. And it seemed as though they weren't taking responsibility for the packaging they were designing. Do you think that it's incumbent upon the recycling community to be better, or is that sort of just dropping your shoulder and shifting the blame a little bit?
I think everybody's part of it. I don't think you can absolve any one part of the supply chain from any of it. So from the point of manufacture right the way around in the circle, everybody has their part to play.
But do you think that that more should be done in recycling, and that not enough is being done, or do we need to fit into what's there already?
Oh, I think there needs to be much more in terms of clarity, consumer education, consumer messaging, all that piece, so that everybody who wants to do the right thing can do the right thing as easily as they possibly can.
Mm, I agree.
Mm. I think there's some interesting numbers to put around this conversation. I mean, the scary number from our point of view is, if you look at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, they'll tell you that 93% of what we send globally to be recycled doesn't get recycled. 93%. So that's a horribly broken system. And by DEFRA's own numbers, that number in the UK is probably about 60%. So only 40% of what we send to be recycled in the UK actually gets recycled. And to put the right infrastructure into place will take at least a decade and billions. And so there's a very, very big question of what do we do now and how do we solve the problem for now? And what we've encountered is we've looked for solutions or approaches to help resolve this issue, this specific issue of plastic in the takeaway sector, is that very often people come from a very, very single point of view, rightly, because they're within their own organisation or NGO. And you'll find very strong arguments against specific conversations. And those are often, the typical industry view at the moment is to recycle out of this. But yeah, we don't have the infrastructure. And if we continue to say that recycling is the only answer, you only need to look at the forecast for plastic production over the next decade. It will rise. And so if you're going to increase the plastic production with a system that's not capable of recycling it, and we've closed our landfill. Landfill in the UK is 85% to 90% full. Mm. And therefore, with a China ban on taking our recycling, it's now going to other places. Hugh Fenley Whittingstall's done a fantastic job of shining a spotlight onto that. Mm. You've got to start to ask, what are the issues, what are the solutions that are capable of dealing with this problem now?
Go on then.
Yeah, go on.
Well,
is it? Yeah.
So yes, it was leading to a two-way conversation, but we have to focus on, you know, let's invoke Greta within the first half an hour, shall we? And you know, we have to move very quickly. We can't have complacency. And what we looked for when we were looking about how to resolve this plastic issue was, are there other materials? Are there innovators out there that are capable of dealing with this solution? And we did a global search for either new materials or new processes that could either get rid of or radically reduce the impact of plastic. And there was very little out there. And this was 2.5, 3 years ago. Mm. And that's frightening in itself. Mm. For the listeners, you'll have seen around this table, there's a collective rolling of the eyeballs because it's just surprising and disappointing. But we did find Knopler, who were dealing with seaweed. And that seaweed story is incredible. It's edible. Mm. Mm. There are 16 billion sachets globally produced of ketchup and pizza dipping sauces. And none of those will be recycled. It's far too food contaminated. It's sitting in the ground for 600 years before it degrades. And that's an annual number. And so these guys have produced a seaweed sachet that works.
So there are developments out there. You know, you're moving things along. And
I think to add to this, really the starting point for us 5 years ago when we decided to embark on this journey was to think of how nature would encapsulate this. And biomimicry, looking at natural materials, we ended up working with seaweed, but there's really exciting things around mushrooms and waste products from the pulp industry, from orange juice industry. There's lots of things that can be used to create a packaging that has a specific shelf life that works with a specific application. And I think that we know, all of us, that there's not going to be one single material that's going to replace all of the plastic because it would just create the same problems as plastic. But when you start to look at it application per application, you start to find that actually this thing is going to be used for an hour. Let's find something that biodegrades in 6 weeks. Mm. This thing is going to be used for a couple of months. Maybe we can live with something that's going to biodegrade in a year.
And are you expecting your product to be put in composting, or does it not matter? Can you just chuck it in the bin and it doesn't matter that it degrades?
So the way we built this material is to be kind of fail-safe. When society fails to take care of its own waste, we don't create a burden on the environment. So it means that regardless of where it ends up, it's not going to create a problem. And so that's why our material will naturally biodegrade without any industrial composting facility like is required for PLA, without any need. We literally have a wormery, a compost bin, under my desk in the office where we test our products. And within
you
10 days,
yeah.
Wormery is very cool.
And so, the material disappears in 10 days faster than an orange peel. So if you can make packaging just like the peel of a fruit, then you have something that nature can work with.
And one thing that's clever about this is that you're taking out the consumer as having to be active in the process, because there is also this concept that when you speak to people about what they care about, they care enormously about sustainability and the environment. But when they actually buy products or have to recycle them, they're actually not that interested. Is that the case, do you find?
Because packaging is so commoditized and boring. But what we've actually seen with something as differentiating as OHO, our bubbles made from seaweed, is that actually they were captivating people's attention like we've never seen before. Like when we did our crowdfunding campaign 2.5 years ago, one video on Facebook got 90 million views. Can you get 90 million people excited about packaging? That's really crazy. So I think that if we move away from classic packaging and we try to find things that are really in adequation with the values of people, they will care and they will do the right thing.
And that's why we've taken the action, is because we have 24 million customers that want to do something about this. And you're absolutely right, they won't make a change of their own volition. And that's the approach we've taken. They won't pay anymore, and they won't change their habits. So we have to make it an accidental byproduct of a wonderful journey. So that when the customer orders a pizza on our platform, it turns up with a sachet, and in the customer research, they love it.
Yeah.
So it drives really great customer advocacy for us. The restaurants love it because they get a kickback on a positive experience from a customer. And we love it because we've hopefully changed things a bit. The colleagues within Just Eat enjoy the fact that we're investing in this type of activity. So it's a natural win-win-win.
And what's lovely is it's very specific to the takeaway concept. I love the timing issue. Absolutely right.
Jim. Does it cost the takeaway shop the same amount or more or less?
It's a great question. And this, when we first started working with Knopfler, what was great about Knopfler is that, I mean, Pierre is hugely humble, but he comes from an FMCG background. You know, he's worked in this space, and their CFO, Lise, was able to show us how this might get to net impact on cost. So at the moment, yes, there's an increase, and we're, to some extent, we've invested to pay for activities to try and mitigate that impact. But at scale, and Pierre does a much better job of this, oil has had, you know, a century of being invested in, a century. And we are, or you guys, are literally trying to invent a machine to do something better in the space of a year.
Yeah.
We've just been running an Innovate government-based grant project. And the progress they've made inside of a year is unbelievable.
That's amazing.
Well done. Brilliant. But they need rockets. You
know? Yeah. And I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's very hard to reach parity quickly with plastic because of how much we've invested in it. And I think that up until recently, it was actually a requirement because of how commoditized packaging is. So we started 5 years ago, and we've seen the conversation with brands changing so rapidly, because now, actually, no one cares about the price. I mean, like, everyone is in damage control. We're working with brands who actually realize that if they don't do something right now, they're spending millions on marketing just to make it okay for their consumers to keep on buying their products. So I think that, yes, we are striving to have a product that is going to be kind of like as cost efficient as plastic in the long run, but we might not even have to, because people are finding ways to kind of like engage with these products, finance the early years of kind of premium in a way that like wasn't possible before, because they thought that people didn't care enough. But it's not the case anymore. So I think that really, when we are talking, like now we're talking with, we're making other kind of like plastic replacement solutions for industries like the fashion industry. The cost, the churn that they're having on people realizing that every single piece of garment is coming in a poly bag, in a plastic bag, is enormous. People are switching out of e-commerce because they are seeing and receiving so much plastic, and they're like disgusted. So the cost to the business is now financing, it's like 100 times the budget of the packaging. So all of a sudden, they are willing to engage with things that might have a premium to start with.
Yeah.
So I think that it's really interesting to see the big picture. It's not just competing with this really efficient piece of plastic, but it's competing with the business you're losing.
And also, you've got a whizzy product. Now, let's get back to the whizzy product.
That's a beautiful link.
I know that it's much more complicated than this, and that it's about strategy, and it's about how you think about it, and it's about politics and regulation. But come on, what's the whizzy new material?
So there's a number of whizzy new things that we're doing. So I don't know if the guys around the table are familiar with the TerraCycle trial that Carrefour have done. Yeah. So we're looking at that, and we're looking... So basically... You pay a deposit for a type of packaging. It comes to your house. You consume the product that's inside it, and then they come and collect the packaging, take it back, wash it, and give you the new product in the same container again. Mm-hmm. So We are looking to go to trial with that along with another number of other manufacturers next year to try and understand more about what that refillable model will bring.
And what is it? Is it going to be glass? Is it going to be
So it could be a different manufacturer looking at different strategies. So ice cream, they're looking at a metal container. For ourselves, it's a glass refillable bottle. We do refillables in various other territories in Europe, Germany being a fairly significant one. So that trial, I think, is going to be quite educational. We also...
Which is, as well as it being an advance, it's sort of retrograde as well. It's going back to an old system. And I used to love bottles. We get milk delivered, but there's not that many people on my street that do. And I love it, but it's more expensive, obviously.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we want to try and understand, Steph, is to what extent will people be prepared to pay a premium to do the right thing?
Yeah.
And at the minute, we don't have that insight. So we're quite excited about this trial when it starts next year.
Yeah.
But another quasi new material that we announced last month is something called the marine bottle. So it's only proof of concept at this stage. It's still a long way away. But essentially what we've done is we've been able to get discarded bottles back from rivers and beaches. And through a different scientific process to do with breaking down the polymers, been able to turn those into new bottles. So we've got 300 bottles that we've got at this stage. We're working with an industry partner. And we now need to see how we can scale it up and see how we can commercialise it.
So for a big company like Coca-Cola, how high up the scale of priorities is packaging sustainability?
That's huge. It has been for years, and it will be for years to come. We've been doing things in this sphere for years and years. We set up the first recycling plant for PET in Lincolnshire in 2012. So this isn't just a reaction to David Attenborough and Sky Ocean Rescue and all this stuff. This is something that's been at the heart of our business for a long time. So that's the end of the party political broadcast. but you could make a case to say that for some people years ago, sustainability was ticking a box and you put it in your corporate report and job done. But now it's intrinsic to the way that investors view your business, and it's intrinsic to the way that consumers view your business. So you need to do something that satisfies both ends of that scale. And if you don't, I would suggest that you might be in trouble.
Mm. So, Jimmy's Coffee, how important is the sustainability of the packaging to your customers, do you think? Really? Because I do get this quite a lot where people say one thing, they don't necessarily follow it through. But what do you think about yours?
I would love to be able to say that people care about it to the point where when we go into aluminium, our unit price will go up because it is much more expensive, and that people will be prepared to pay whatever it's going to be, 5p, 7p.
Is that the likely price, the extra price?
Don't hold me to that actual number, but it will be more expensive than the carton. And I'd love it if people actually did go, I don't mind paying that because I know I'm going to be able to, that's infinitely recyclable, and I know I can throw it in that bin and I know it'll probably be back on the shelf in a week's time. But I genuinely don't know if that is the case. I really don't, because I mean we surround ourselves with people that would, but then the majority of people, I just don't know.
Yeah. There's also, when you take a decision like this and you know that it's going to cost a little bit more money for the product itself, you kind of want to shout about it, don't you? And is there a limit to how much information you can just fit on the packaging about how wonderful you are? There's lots of other issues that you want to talk about as well on your packaging.
Well, yes, because we are Rainforest Alliance Coffee, and we feel that that's the frog badge, which I call it. I love, and I think it's a recognisable symbol that the shopper in their sort of 0.2 of a second of a decision-making time to choose a product, it's a good little flash of what would make them feel a bit comfortable. It's a comforting badge, so to speak. Mm. I think, you know, it can be too noisy, and you can talk about this recycle and that recycle, but again, the recycling logo, if it's just nice and simple, I think, again, is a nice comforting thing.
It's a part of your whole communications strategy piece, isn't it? So through social media, through your on-pack stuff, through podcasts like this, just trying to explain that we're doing our best to make it right, and trying to touch as many people through those strategies is the way to go about doing it.
Yeah, there's so many messages, aren't there? Especially for you know, emerging brands who authenticity is really important, but then having to shout about something to say why it's 7p more sort of goes against that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But then we did a stat the other day where we worked out the cap and the neck of the plastic top of our cartons at the moment. They're sort of two pieces effectively, because you can take the, obviously remove the cap from the neck. And we worked out that by not having the carton next year will be 9 million pieces of plastic that won't be in our bins. And that is a really, it's a lovely visual message. Everyone can, well, I don't know how high that would be, Eiffel Tower or whatever. I'm sure we could work it out. But I think those are good messages for people, especially when we're meeting buyers, because you can actually sort of go, wow, okay, I get that. And it sort of then makes it okay. It softens the price blow, which is ultimately what it all comes down to.
I could carry on for hours here because it's such a vital subject and there's so much going on and you've all got some exciting projects. But we need to wrap it up. And what I'd like to wrap it up with is two things for everyone to say, if you don't mind. What you think is exciting about the future, whether that might be the next year or the next 20 years. And what do you think is going to be one of the negatives? What's one of the risks? And what do you worry about as well? Robin, would you mind starting? What's exciting and what's worrying about in the future for Just Eat?
There are some interesting projects that we're working on at the moment. There's some interesting technology coming to the market. We're working at the moment with a company that's made an additive that you would put into it, into the plastic pellet before it's injection molded, and at a predetermined time in the future would, within the space of a month, degrade that plastic to carbon dioxide and water. It's not
sounds like a magic pill to me, isn't it?
It is a magic pill. It's a patented process. It's FDA approved. It works. It's not oxycycling. It doesn't leave particles of plastic in the soil. Well, all of that multiple of objections that people often levy. And in conversations with lots of NGOs and people like that, this thing might just work. It does have some issues around it. But I think there are, we need more of that. That's another UCL, NOPLA came out of the UCL, University College of London, funding innovation labs. You know, we need more innovation like that. And to have found two of the best pieces of information just from the UCL suggests that the other organizations globally can contribute a lot more to this space and innovation. So I'd like to see a lot more conversation on innovation. I network heavily and work heavily with the plastics industry, with the packaging industry, and it's all about recycling. But that's right, we need to do more of that, but I'd like to see more of innovation. What scares me is that we need to widen the breadth of this conversation, and plastics is an absolutely really vital piece of this debate. But the wider debate is the climate change and is the impact of CO2 and what we're putting into the atmosphere at the moment. And we need to understand that debate. We need to take radical and quick action on it, on trying to mitigate the impact. Mm.
Okay, Gordon?
Yeah, I would echo somewhat Robin said. I think that what is exciting is that the way that people are now viewing this whole debate. Mm. You know, you mentioned Greta a few minutes ago, and there's so much energy and enthusiasm from consumers that they are viewing it in a way that arguably wasn't the case in previous generations or 20, 30 years ago, whatever it might be. So I think that's really exciting. And I think there's lots of people doing lots of really great work in terms of trying to find solutions for this. So I think that is really exciting in terms of the way we move forward. What's negative? I think perhaps people aren't moving as quickly as they would want to do. And whilst at Coca-Cola, we're doing a lot of things to try and get on the front foot, so moving to higher percentage of recycled PET in our plastic bottles, for example. I would like to see other people in other spaces trying to do things on a quicker basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm also very excited about the packaging space, because I think that no space has seen the amount of disruption that we're seeing right now. It's even greater than Silicon Valley is kind of like a golden age of information. I think that the shift is so rapid that we have the ability to switch out of the current kind of like bias and infrastructure that we've built for ourselves around plastic. So I think that's really exciting to spark a lot of new alternatives. As you were saying, you went to Tetra Pak, they didn't have an answer, but a startup might have, or a university might have. So I think that it's a stage where we're not leaving it to the hands of the Tetra Paks of this world to come up with the solution. And I think what worries me is dishonesty. I think that in packaging, there's a lot of kind of like gray area where you're doing a bit, but not that much. You're communicating around something, but actually it's not doing everything that you say. I'm not going to bash PLA, but I think it's one of those where it's written compostable, but really it isn't.
Yeah.
So I think that this is where we're going to have to be a lot more like careful about how we do things and how we communicate and what are the rules to communicate about these things. And I think that's where government also has a role to play, so that we don't dilute ourselves in like a nice story without actually delivering impact.
Yeah.
I think I've got to echo that. But it's such a danger. We go to these fairs of packaging and 90% of what you see is greenwash. And that's really dangerous when it gets to a customer, because they desperately want to take action. And I'll let you, I mean, this is a, I don't know whether I should share the story.
Then exactly you should. that's what we want to hear.
I gave evidence at the EFRA Select Committee in Parliament. And they
What's
said,
that, sorry, the EFRA?
It's the EFRA is the Oversight Committee of DEFRA. So it's a government oversight of packaging and all the impacts of what we're doing. And we were hauled up in front of the Select Committee. You get videoed. It's a very serious process.
Wow.
They served us water in ostensibly biodegradable cups. Now, those cups I know very well, and at the moment they do not compost unless they reach one of about three industrial sites in the country, and it's greenwash.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's widely accepted, and I applaud them, frankly. And this is not just me trying to cover my back. I applaud them for trying to do the right thing. We all want to do the right thing, but the level of greenwash and legislation, it's not caught up with this conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know what greenwash is, I'm sorry.
It's where brands will label something as having a positive, sustainable effect, but it's absolutely rubbish in the end of it, to call it to camera. So
difficult to follow through, as you say,
the right recycling facilities aren't there. Biodegradable things are not biodegradable, because a biodegradable plastic, to Pierre's point, is often made of PLA. And when it goes to a normal recycling plant, will actually cause problems at scale with the recycling, not capable of dealing with it. And also, when it does degrade, it degrades back into a harmful form of microparticle in the soil. And it will take decades to centuries to degrade anyway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear. Okay. Right. So back to Jimmy's coffee. What are you excited about? What are you worried about, Jim?
I'm going to start with the worry, actually. Mm-hmm. So the worry is, I've got two kids, age 6 and 4, and I kind of think, right, you know, they're going to grow up. And when I've passed away and they've got kids and their kids and their kids, you kind of think, what on earth is going to be going on?
On
this earth. And the thing that excites me is our business is now in a position where we can turn our hand to other projects. So we're creating quite an interesting social responsibility plan focused around using the power of positivity to get young people to think wider and more bigger about things. Mm-hmm. So we want to try and reach as many young kids as we possibly can, using our kind of positivity tools to empower them and know that they need to start actively thinking about recycling and doing good and all those kind of things. So that's the kind of light at the end of the tunnel for me. And it's nice to be able to go and do that.
Absolutely. Okay, Suze?
What I find exciting is that because the David Attenborough thing, let's say it was that that sparked the moment for all of us. Is how many people there are, like yourself, Pierre, that are out there doing things. And you hear about these projects and people that are trying to course correct big time. And it's fascinating and it's really, really interesting to learn about these new ways and means of being able to have our packaging in. But what scares me is that I think it's the amount of time it's going to take. And it really worries me, particularly Robin, when you said... If such a low percentage of our items are not even recycled anyway, then I just feel really sad about that. Mm. I think, gosh, you know, I'm hopeless, so excited. I was literally thought everyone recycles aluminium. It's obvious. It's a, you know, and I feel quite deflated about that. And I feel like it is a government thing that needs to start from the top. That's a very, very simple process that everyone understands from the length and breadth of this country, that everyone adheres to, that will actually help to make that carton, that will keep that can sitting on that table, be back in Tesco's in 3 months' time.
Mm. Well, I tell you what, I'm not deflated, I'm optimistic, because there's all this potential now. Since we know that so much is not recycled, there's a huge amount of potential to do so much better. And everyone here seems to be doing a fantastic thing and have fantastic roles to try and push that forward. Thank you so much, everybody. So we've been listening to Robin Clark, Gordon McSkimming, Pierre Paslier, Jim Cregan and Suze Cregan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.